Thank you for joining us today. We're discussing the shift from hiring to upskilling. If you don't know who we are at HowNow, my name is Gary Stringer. I'm the content marketing manager here. I'll be facilitating this great conversation between our CEO and co-founder, Nelson Sivillingham, and Easy Generator co-founder and chief strategist, Casper Spiro. We'll get into the full context in a moment, but I thought it'd be nice for people to hear who both of you are and what your respective companies do. So Casper, could you kick us off?
Yes, thank you. So I'm Casper Spiro, based in the Netherlands, and I work for Easy Generator. I'm also the co-founder of the company, and we are an authoring tool, but not just an authoring tool like you have many, but we focus on helping subject matter experts to create learning content. So we have a special approach for that called empathy-generated learning, and that is sort of what sets apart. So it's a very simple tool with a simple methodology to help people create learning.
Perfect. And Nelson, over to you.
Yeah, great to be back on the show with Casper. And I guess in terms of what we do at HowNow is, I'm sure many of you have been at organizations or probably at organizations now where people say learning feels like a bit of an unwanted interruption, and therefore you're not getting the engagement you want with the learning experiences that you're working hard to create and curate. And that's essentially where HowNow comes in. We help you take learning from feeling like an interruption to making an integrated part of everyday work. We do that by giving you the platform that helps you connect right learning to the right person based on their skills gaps and delivering it in the flow of work. So you get a lot more engagement and people building the skills that they need.
Perfect. Very fitting, because we're about to discuss pretty much both of those two things you just both described for the next hour-ish. So I wanted to set a little bit of context with some statistics before we dive into the conversation. The first is that CBI just published a report, I think in the last couple of weeks, that 9 in 10 UK employees will need reskilling by 2030. That equates to 26 million people needing upskilling to keep up with tech and business evolution, and 5 million people who will need to go through fundamental job change and retraining. The C-suite executives surveyed by edX estimated that about half of the skills that exist in the workforce won't be relevant in just a few years. And the same survey showed that a third of employees feel they lack the skills they'll need to perform their role in the future. So it seems like we're all aligned about the severity of the situation. But what we want to unpack today is, why is it so crucial now, and how do we make that shift tactically from hiring to upskilling? So Nelson, to come to you first, I want to set a bit more context, but why is it becoming increasingly more difficult for companies to fill their skills gaps just through hiring? And what are some of the limitations when they rely too heavily on hiring versus upskilling and developing talent?
Yeah, I guess in short, the problem is a skills shortage. Right. That's what's making it very, very difficult and expensive for people to be able to always focus on just buying talent rather than building talent within their organization. And if we step back to understand why is this happening? Well, it's happening because we're experiencing an exponential rate of change. Now, we're often we play down exponential change. Many of us suffer from what they call exponential growth bias, which is when someone says something is growing exponentially, we don't quite understand that. A great example of it is something like COVID, right? It is, people say this is spreading exponentially, you should wear a mask, you should do social distancing. A lot of people were like, nah, it's not gonna spread. We don't need to wear a mask, why do I need to? And that's basically exponential growth bias. And we do that all the time. Technology is changing exponentially. We play down the effects. But what the consequence of exponential change is, the demand grows a lot faster than we're able to grow the supply, right? And to give you a recent stat that came out, which I thought was fascinating, was in the US, 3 out of 4 employers reported struggling to fill their vacancies, right? And to give you a specific skill set where there's a lot of demand for right now is cybersecurity. So cybersecurity is an example of a role where there's a much, much higher demand than there is supply, to the point where 56% of companies reported struggling to report for cybersecurity roles. Now, what that tells you is that change drives the need and demand much faster than we're able to upskill and therefore be able to buy that skill set on the market. Now, you combine that with there's a skill shortage, there's less people, therefore it's a lot more competitive to hire externally. which internally, what does that mean for you? Well, it means there's great opportunity in the job market for your people. So if you're not helping them grow in your current organization and you're not valuing the skills they bring to the table, they'll leave, because actually there's so much great opportunity out there for those skills. So the combination of a competitive job market with companies being very bad at upskilling and growing their people is almost the perfect storm for why hiring is no longer going to work as the primary strategy, and companies need to focus on upskilling.
Yeah, and we've been banging this drum for a while, actually, and you just reminded me of something I read probably 2 or 3 years ago, but Booking.com were doing a similar thing where they couldn't recruit a particular type of developer in whatever the software language was. So they were looking for people who had the most adjacent one and offering this really good opportunity to come learn this new coding language that was very in demand at Booking.com. So I think it's great that it's really coming to fruition now and everyone's talking about it. But yeah, it's been like a sort of ongoing problem as well, hasn't it, for a few years. Casper, any thoughts on that, why it's becoming more difficult to fill skills gaps, or just in general, the pitfalls of relying too heavily on hiring as well?
Yeah, so I agree with everything Nelson said, so all that is valid. So we were, just before we were going on air, we were talking about that I go to Dubai next week because that's where our head office is, and it's driven for the lack of getting people. So the reason was, in the Netherlands, where our head office was, we're not able to hire enough people with the right quality and in the right pace. So we actually went there, not for the market, the sales market, but actually for the people market to get more people. We now have like, I think, 90 people working there or something like that in 2 years' time. So that is just an example how much shortage there is. And on top of all the things that were mentioned, I think that the problem becomes worse because the lifetime of a skill becomes shorter and shorter. I read an article, so people talk about half lifetime of a skill, which doesn't mean the half of the time. It's like with nuclear energy, it's like, but when it's half time, then you can't use it anymore. It's not valid anymore. So I read, I think it was a research of IBM that they said that the average skill half time is now 4 years. And for technical skills, it's 2.5 years. And in the same article, I read that it takes 8 months to onboard a new person. So if you hire a new person and you have to onboard them, it's like 8 months. It will take 2.5 years to actually for that skill to be diminished in value. So there is a constant pressure. So I was a bit surprised when you said that 9 out of 10 people need to be reskilling. I think everybody needs reskilling all the time. So for example, if you just look at AI, so most people haven't really actively worked with that maybe a year ago. And now we're all looking at ChatGPT and prompt engineering. All new skills are popping up. So you need to keep developing that constantly. But it becomes harder and harder because the lifetime of a skill is dropping and dropping. So the pressure on reskilling on a permanent basis becomes ever increasing.
Yeah.
I mean, AI is probably a great example of another case of where the demand shot up a lot faster than the supply was. I mean, if you look at the AI, the salary for an AI engineer, the highest I've seen in the market is $210,000 for an AI engineer. Why is it so high? You know, people only talk about the fact that why are they getting paid so much money? It's because there aren't enough humans who have that skill set to fill the demand for those roles. And so how many companies can afford to be going out into the market and competing with some of the biggest tech companies in the world to pay that kind of salary for AI engineers? And so the only way you can compete and avoid falling behind is not by trying to compete in the job market, but by investing in your people who are within the organization now.
When you hear it in those terms, it makes you realize just how sort of against the clock we can be when it comes to skills. And also, like you said, the idea of seizing opportunities, sometimes you can't hire and onboard quick enough to seize an opportunity, but you can maybe build the skill internally to get there quicker. And that, I think what Casper said particularly leads us on to this second contextual part of why now, you know, why is it so critical now that upskilling is part of our response to rapid change and disruption in our business environment. So any thoughts on that, Nelson? Like why now, I guess, is the short version of that question.
Yeah, I guess it builds on what we've discussed now, right? Is the change that we're continuously seeing, and there's many examples of that. But I think if you step back, change isn't new, but the rate is exponential. So this problem, if we don't do anything about it, it's just going to get worse, right? It's just going to get harder for companies to be able to get the skills they need, not just to innovate, right? I think sometimes companies make the mistake of thinking, well, I only really need to do this if I need to innovate and disrupt. No, when it gets competitive exponentially, it will become very difficult for you to even get the skills to get simple work done, right? Because your people are going to leave and go to organizations where their growth is supported. And therefore, you're just going to struggle to have the right people to get the job done. And so it asks a bigger question, really, around the idea that the sustainable competitive advantages that we used to depend on, say, like 20 years ago, are no longer moats, right? You know, before it used to be enough if you had the cheapest product or you had the highest quality product, or at one point you hired the best people. That was enough, right? But that none of those things is no longer enough to give you a sustainable competitive advantage. And I think in this environment, the only real sustainable competitive advantage you can have is the rate at which you can upskill. Right? It's not even upskilling. If you're not right now investing in upskilling and reskilling, you've already fallen behind, right? To play in the game today, the question is the rate at which you can upskill, right? The speed at which you can learn and the ability to do that in your organization. How quickly are you learning and able to apply what you learn is really the only sustainable competitive advantage you can have as an organization. And that's the why now, right? Is you can't hire quick enough. So you have to look at how quickly you can upskill.
On that point of hiring, Casper, when we spoke about this briefly before, you'd mentioned this idea of potentially hiring for talent that then you can help build the skills, and how we can maybe look for people who have the ability to learn quickly, to Nelson's point. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, indeed. So indeed, because it is not only that the half time of skills is decreasing, it's indeed also the speed of change is picking up. If you so basically the last big revolution we had in the world of working and learning was the rise of the internet. And that took like 20 years to come to a full impact. It's still, you still now see shops going bankrupt and streets getting empty. With AI, the impact is way bigger and way faster. So it goes faster. So, and indeed, it's almost impossible to keep up with hiring. But indeed, I believe you shouldn't hire for skills, because the value of a skill is diminishing. You should indeed hire for talent. So you should find people who are smart enough, who have the right mindset, who are willing to learn, who are able to learn, who are able to permanently develop. So things like lifelong learning, we talk about that already for a long time, but you need people who can learn and have the talent to develop things. So that is more important than being able to do stuff right away.
I think this is where I love the way, I was going to say, yeah, I love the way Satya Nadella, that Microsoft CEO, framed this in terms of, you know, we shouldn't be hiring for know-it-alls, we should be hiring for learn-it-alls. Right. Correct. And that's exactly what we should be looking at, because that sums it up, right? People are not going to have, you're not going to hire someone who's going to have all the skills you need for every eventuality, especially given the rate of change.
Is there any ways you can spot that trait in people when you are going through a hiring process? Is it kind of curiosity is a trait you're looking for, or things they're learning outside of potentially like their education or the job they're doing at the moment? Yeah. I wonder.
Yeah, definitely. So, I've been the CEO of the company for the first 11 years, so I'm no longer doing that for like 2 years, but I was always having the last conversation of every hire we had. And I wasn't concerned if they were like a great salesperson or a great marketing person, so that was already covered before that. So I was talking to them about our values, how they would fit in, and asking for examples. But also there are certain things that I liked a lot. So people are really successful in sports, for example, or people who studied abroad. Those kind of things are a signal for people who are having the right mindset, willing to take risk, willing to learn, willing to put it all out there. So those are really, were always pluses if I ever looked at somebody's resume.
Yeah, I agree with Casper, and kind of add to that, I feel like my entire life has been around trying to figure this question out, because it's the most fascinating thing to go, what are the signals? Because I do, over time, having met interviewed many, many people, worked with so many different founders across different businesses. I actually think it's the single most important attribute for someone's success is their ability to learn and how quickly they learn and figure things out. And I think it's often one of the question areas for me when interviewing is, actually, what does someone do when something goes wrong, right? And how's someone's reflective process and how they're able to deconstruct, take the lessons away from that is almost, some people do it without recognizing they do it, which is even better because it means they're continuously learning at speed. I often ask people, what was the last thing they changed their mind about? And because that also tells you, they may have held an opinion about something, but actually they learned about it based on interactions and things that happened, and they were able to change their perspective and adapt, et cetera. But yeah, it's definitely a evolving practice because it is definitely one of the hardest things to do.
Yeah. I'd love to know, there's a couple of comments in the chat about the growth mindset idea, and I'd love to know if anyone else has any tips or thoughts on how you can spot those people. Funny enough, personally, I was one of those not know it all, learn it all people, because I know I don't look a day over 25. But when I graduated from uni about over a decade ago, I did a degree that was almost completely obsolete because it was right on the cusp of very digital, like moving towards very digital marketing from print and lots of outdoor and ambient. So I had to like learn everything really quickly. And that is a nice segue because we want to talk a little bit more about the tactical aspects of the first steps we can take as we shift from just hiring to upskilling and reskilling people to make sure they have the right skills for future-proofing themselves, but also that business impact and solving problems. So Casper, what are your thoughts? The first steps people can take to shift towards upskilling?
Yeah, so I think we already touched a bit on the fact that it has to do with what kind of people you get in. So it's not only hiring for talent, but you have other criteria that are more important than being able to fit the current job. So you are hiring for the future, basically. That I think that is really different. So you need to look at the criteria you have for hiring and probably also the processes that you use. The other thing is when you start training and learning people. So I think that one of the challenges we have is that a lot of learning material is still very knowledge heavy. It is fact-based, it is knowledge transfer. And we need to move more and more towards skills training. And that's a challenge because with e-learning, it's easy to transfer knowledge. It's harder to actually teach a skill. And for that, you need a blended approach. It's not sufficient to do things online. You need to be able to practice things. You need to have somebody who actually tells you what you do wrong and how you can improve. So we need to change the whole mindset of learning and switching to a skills-based approach instead of just a knowledge-based approach. And I think we have a long way to go there.
Is there an example you could give of this idea of a piece of knowledge-driven content and what a skills-driven type model might look like, just to help people visualize or imagine what the problem is?
Well, if you look at most, for example, onboarding trainings you need to follow when you join a company, there is so much information you need to digest just to get onboarded, while a lot of that information probably will not even use while you're working. So that is a very simple example. And I speak to a lot of learning managers, and I just recently started asking them the question in the talks we have. So if you look critically at the content that you create and that you have in your learning management system, your learning experience platform, so if you make a division between knowledge-driven content and skills-based-driven content, how is the division? Is it 50-50? Is it different? And it's probably closer to 90-10 or something like that between knowledge-driven content and skills-based content and programs in general.
That onboarding example, Casper, really resonates because I think it's one of the most common things we see is, you know, dump every bit of information someone needs to know within the first few weeks. I'm amazed so new starters then get scared off and leave just after seeing that. But I mean, one of the changes we made many, many years ago about around our onboarding, like if you take a sales role, was to actually focus it around what's that first milestone? What's that first application that we need to see? So if you take a salesperson, it might be the first call they're going to have with a potential customer. And so the entire onboarding, other than the company stuff, actually, it was like you only need to know enough to be able to achieve that first milestone, which is to hold a initial discovery conversation with a potential customer. I think there's only so much you can retain. And often what you find is, A, it's difficult to retain, and B, if you've got long-form e-learning content, it's also really difficult for someone to revisit this content and find exactly the nugget they need. And so a lot of broken onboarding experiences is what we see across organizations. But yeah, that really resonates.
Yeah, I think you're right. That onboarding one is a great example, because once you take that mindset of actually how do we get this person to the milestone we need to get them to, we do move away from just like death by content. And we say, well, if the first port of call is you need to do a discovery call, we'll probably get people to record themselves doing one. And then it might be a progression to people join as mock customers and they give you feedback. And that, I think, speaks to Casper's point of it's more skill driven because you're applying it in the build up to something that has purpose. So I really like that idea of that being a great example. And yeah, I think everyone can probably relate who's here to just that overwhelming onboarding amount of content. And you're already thinking, oh, have I made the right decision in that week? And you get hit with 700 PDFs. Oh man, I'm struggling.
I remember the experience, which was really cool. So in my previous job, so we're talking now more than 15 years ago, but one of the projects I did was for Shell, the oil company, and they have really strict security rules. So before you're allowed to go on a rig or a tanker, you need to take a course and you need to be certified. But the cool thing is they apply a bundle of those rules in their offices as well. So for example, when you enter the head office, they tell you have to hold the rail of the staircase when you go up, because you have to do that as well. So it's really interesting because it gives you sort of a mindset that goes for the rest of the company. And you don't get, of course, the full thing, but it immediately brings something home. Wait a minute, that's interesting. I've never experienced that before. And I really like that. And I don't think any compliance training or security training can achieve that, that kind of awareness.
Mm.
Nelson, as well, from your perspective, thinking about the steps people can take to that shift towards upskilling, reskilling their existing talent versus hiring, what are some of those steps you would advise people to take?
Yeah, I think it first starts with L&D changing the question that they're asking, right? I think right now it comes very much from a content-centric mindset, which is the question L&D asks themselves is, you know, what content do these people need and how am I going to get this content to them? And neither of those questions, the answers will lead you towards upskilling and reskilling. It will just lead you towards pushing out a lot of content and tracking whether people have completed the content or not. So we need to reframe the question. And the question we need to ask ourselves is, you know, what skills do these people need and how am I going to help them build these skills? Now, that's a very different question. And it's also a different set of questions that the business can get on board with. And so I think once you change that question, it changes everything we do to try to answer that question. And we end up taking a more skills first approach to L&D. So let's break that down. What does that look like? So right now we're trying to understand content needs, right? We're trying to understand, all right, what content does this team need? Instead, if we take a skills first approach, we're proactively monitoring and measuring skills in the organization and looking at where the organization wants to go. And we're proactively flagging these are the gaps that are going to stop us from achieving these objectives and goals that the business has. So it moves away from a reactive content needs focus to a more proactive skills needs focus. It also changes how we think about content. Rather than trying to create all of the content, what it focuses on is L&D to focus on curating a more broader ecosystem of learning resources that can support someone in building those skills. You know, that could be a little nugget. It could be a course. It could be mentoring. It could be a blog. It could be a podcast. But the reality is there's a range of different resources that can help us build the skills that we need. And then it also changes how we think about access and delivery. It's no longer around, you know, put it in my LMS and they'll find it or come into a classroom. It's how do we deliver relevant learning so I can practice those skills in those moments of need, right? It might be the fact that I'm on a call with a customer and I need to have a better way of handling it. How can I deliver learning and nudges within that? So it changes the way we think about delivery of learning. And the last thing it changes what we measure, right? Rather than measuring time spent learning and content completion, which tells us nothing about whether you've helped bridge a skills gap or not, we start to build our impact narrative based on skills, right? Have we actually helped bridge the skills gaps that the business cares about? And so I think taking a skills first approach to L&D changes every step within that kind of L&D journey. And I think that's the key for us to be able to upskill and reskill. Otherwise, we'll be stuck pushing out content that's not getting a lot of engagement, and it's probably not helping people build the skills they need.
Yeah. To that point, we've got a question in the chat, Nelson, that I think goes to that very first step of identifying the skills you need, especially the question is framed around if it's a large group of people and there's 3,000 employees, for example. How can you, in such a large group, spot the skills gaps you need? Would it be a case of actually prioritization of where the most pressing ones are, starting with that, or is there another tactic people could apply?
Yeah, I'd say there's a couple of steps you can break this down to. The first step is, are you measuring skills? Now, to do it at that skill, this is a technology problem. And this is exactly what our customers use How Now for. So let's break down that problem. The first problem is knowing what skills should they have, right? Now, you might try to do this manually where you're talking to your managers. You might try to do a Google search. You might ask ChatGPT. You might bring in an external consultant. And there are so many manual and broken ways of doing this. But this is where How Now collects and analyzes millions and millions of job adverts on a day-to-day basis to identify the most in-demand skills for any particular job. So based on this large language data set that we have, we're able to tell you these are the skills that this person should have. We then combine that with any talent data that you have in your HR system, where we can make an inference around what skills you may have acquired based on your previous work history. So that's the first question answered. What skills should they have? The second question is, what skills do they actually have? And to what level of mastery do they have those skills? And this is where, within How Now, we have a built-in 360 measurement tool, which combines self-assessment, manager assessment, and peer assessment to give you an average skills proficiency score for every skill that you have. Now, this is deliberately designed to be light touch, because if you gave someone a 100 question assessment to answer to get their skills level, they might do it once because you forced them to do it, but they're not going to do it continuously. So you'll never be able to track the skills progression over a period of time. Now, within those first two steps, we've helped our customers measure and track the skills they have and don't have within their organization. And the third question becomes bridging the gap that you've now identified. Now, in terms of prioritizing the skills to tackle, it's a combination of top-down and bottom-up. Top-down is the business knows where it wants to go. There's a vision, there's a strategy. Now you look at the strategy and go, okay, what are the skills that are going to have the biggest impact on delivering this strategy? And where do we have our biggest gaps? That will tell you where are the skills that you should focus on across every department. And then the bottom-up approach is asking each individual to pick maybe 3 to 5 focus skills. What do they think are the skills that are going to most help them improve their performance? And I think in those 3 steps, you can get to a point where now we have a skills first strategy where we're prioritizing the skills that are going to have the biggest impact on business performance.
I think that also answers Linda's follow-up question in the chat. But Linda, if you have a follow-up, then do let us know and we can pitch that at the end. But I think it links back to your first point, Nelson, at the rate of change, there's things we just can't do manually if we're going to build skills at scale. And I think auditing and mapping manually is going to happen so slowly that you'll miss the opportunity that we spoke about as well. Casper, any thoughts on this? We've got a couple more talking points we want to move into, but just any thoughts on the stuff Nelson just shared there?
No, I think that we covered it quite completely. So the bottom line is that it changes the whole process from hiring to how you look at skilling and how you attract skilling and everything. So I think that we covered all those points, but it is like a fundamental change for any learning department to move towards that direction.
Perfect. So the next question is, we talked about tactical things people can apply. I think it's also useful of us to cover some of the pitfalls that might hinder people when it comes to their upskilling efforts and the barriers they'll typically face. So Nelson, did you want to kick us off and then we'll go to Casper again?
Yeah, I guess a couple of things that if you think you can upskill and reskill by investing more in more fun and interactive content, that's a common pitfall. People just think more content is the answer to upskilling and reskilling. Then there's probably the kind of sunk cost fallacy. There are many of you probably listening to this right now going, actually, it makes sense. We should probably implement these things, but I've just spent money on A, B, and C and got a budget for this. And Therefore, I know what I'm doing probably isn't the solution, but I should probably stick with it because I've already spent the money on it, is the age-old sunk cost fallacy. And the reality of the sunk cost fallacy is you end up actually wasting more money, more time, more resources that you probably unaccounted for as a result of sticking with something that you already know isn't going to deliver the impact that you need. And that's a common mistake we see. The other one kind of extension of that is falling in love with the solution. Right, we almost have this habit in L&D of kind of rushing to the solution and getting it out there, and instead we don't spend enough time necessarily on loving the problem and the problem discovery. And in this particular case, skills gaps is the problem, right? Really understanding what are the skills that are affecting, and not spending enough time in that part of the process of understanding why does this skill matter, how is it going to contribute to the business performance, and really doing the discovery element there. And the last one I'd probably say is it requires a change in how we think about the ownership of upskilling and reskilling, where it's not L&D's ownership, right? L&D are not the only one who are responsible for actual learning and development within the organization. They're the enablers. They reduce the friction in the process of upskilling and reskilling, but it really needs to be a collective ownership. Right, it needs to be owned by the manager. It needs to be owned by every individual in the company, and it needs to be owned by the business. And so it's a collective ownership to build the skills to get the work done, which is opposes the traditional mindset of L&D, which is L&D are the only ones who do everything related to learning and development. That can't sustain for you to be able to scale upskilling at speed.
Perfect. And Casper, from your mindset, what are the common pitfalls people can fall into?
Yeah, I think that's probably the most important thing is culture and mindset. So any initiative you take, if it doesn't have like the proper soil to seed in, then it will not grow. So I think that's really important. And we have so in principle, we already all know that every worker needs to become a learner as well. We talked about that. You need to be constantly evolving. So it means it's not just that you need to become a learner, you need to become a lifelong learner. So I'm now 61, and luckily I still learned every day. And the moment that I stop learning, I probably will be dead. But it needs to be the mindset that you want to learn, that you want to develop, that you're eager to find new things, and that you, so embracing change, for example, is one of the things that is part of that mindset, that you like change. And a lot of people do not like change, but you need to like change in order to be able to adapt to it. And it's just a fact of life, that change. But I think there's even another step in actually, if we talk about skills, then we already spoke a bit about mentorship and stuff like that. And I think that it's crucial that every worker not only becomes a learner and a lifelong learner, I think that every learner needs to become a teacher and a mentor as well. Because you need to have that in your culture, that anyone can help out anyone else on a certain thing because they have experienced that or a different view on that. And if you have that in your company, then you build something that is sort of, that will sustain itself. And the interesting thing is, if you talk about mentorships and teaching, very often people then think about really senior people in your organization that need to do that. But the interesting thing is, for example, at DC Generator, we have like 200 people now. And I'm 61, as I said. I think the next one in age is probably somewhere around 40 or even less. So I could be the father of everyone. And that's interesting because I bring a lot of experience to the table and that I can share. But especially the new generation now joining the company, they have such a different mindset and experience on how to create content, how to use social media, and all those kinds of things, how to be always connected. I can learn so much from them. So it's interesting that basically everybody can become a teacher and should become a teacher and a mentor in certain aspects.
I love that, Casper, around that everyone should be a teacher and mentor. And it reminds me of a lot of the conversation we have at How Now around trying to encourage people to, you know, build their personal brand and post on LinkedIn. And one of the most common concerns or pushbacks I hear is people are like, but I'm not too sure I'm an expert, right? Yeah, I don't know if I'm an expert. You know, the imposter syndrome kicks in. And I think it's just recognizing that we all know something that the other person doesn't know, right? We're all, expert is a very relative term, right? It depends who you're in the room with. And depending on who you're in the room with, we're likely to be experts in one thing over the other thing for someone. I think, yeah, sometimes I find imposter syndrome holds people back from being a teacher and a mentor, but it's such a great cultural pillar to have.
Funny enough, Casper, you said something over a year ago when we spoke that stuck in my brain, and a testament to my long-term memory is still there. But you said, if someone in your company has a question, someone else probably has the answer. And that's the culture we need to be fostering. So I think removing the hierarchy of who can teach who what and making sure everyone has an equal platform to share that knowledge upwards and downwards through the hierarchy is such a great mindset shift as well. So I really like that. We have one more talking point we're going to go through. So if you do have questions, drop them in the Q&A now, and then we'll get to them very shortly. But the final question we want to put to you is, what are some of the steps that L&D pros can take to get buy-in for their Skills First Learning initiatives? So Casper, kick us off. Any thoughts on how we get buy-in for this Skills First initiative approach?
Yeah, so that's interesting, because I don't agree with this question, because in the question, there's an assumption that the learning and development team is responsible for learning. Nelson already touched a bit on that. If you want to create a learning culture where everybody develops their own skills, it is the worker, the learner, the mentor who is responsible for that. So I think very often we as L&D people think that learning is our responsibility and our problem, but that's not the case. The support of learning is our responsibility and our problem. So you need to find the support or the kind of learning that people need to do in order to grow. And of course, there is direction from the company. Like Nelson said, you have like a strategy and you need certain skills for that. But it is people who need to be motivated to do that and people who need to initiate that. And you as an L&D department are just there to serve them and to help them to do that. And that is a really different mindset, because we are always going like in within a top-down approach, but learning actually is a bottom-up thing. And although there is some direction top-down, I think that most of the learning needs to happen bottom-up. And it's also so, I always hate conversation on how do we make learning more attractive and interactive and how can we motivate people to do that. All those things handle from the assumption that you push learning to somebody and they don't want to learn it, but you need to sort of make it a bit better. And that is always bad.
Yeah, it's funny. It's like you said, it's if we align to the problems we need to solve, or to Nelson's point earlier, we know the skills we need for the business to succeed, then we're not pushing for buy-in, because we're aligned to where everyone wants to go and we're a part of facilitating that. So I do like that sort of pushback on the framing. Nelson, any thoughts on that as well?
Yeah, I think just to add to, I agree with what Casper said, and kind of building on that, it's this idea that a skills-first approach actually inherently makes it easier to get buy-in, because you end up speaking a language that the business understands. Now, if we think about how we approach L&D right now in terms of a more content-first approach, content isn't a language that the C-suite and the rest of the business understands, right? The rest of the business doesn't care how many pieces of content was completed. They don't care how much time was spent on content. You're basically speaking a language that only L&D care about. The rest of the business doesn't care. Whereas the move towards the skills first allows you to now use a language that is better understood, right? The employee understands skills. They understand whether they have skills, they don't have skills, and they need to improve skills. The C-suite understands skills because they understand that the business doesn't have skills and they need to build skills. So by speaking a language that's better understood by other people in the organization, it naturally makes it easier for you to be able to get buy-in. Now, to build on that, in terms of putting forward your business case, we often talk about speaking about return on investment, but we often recommend to our organization, definitely ROI is great, but many people find it challenging to be able to come up with ROI, especially for a project they've never done before. They don't have enough data. And we recommend, instead of ROI, using COI, which is cost of inaction, right? Now, we often find as individuals, the thing that drives us to make many decisions is loss aversion, right? So in essence, what I'm saying is you would be much more upset with losing £100 than you would be happy getting £100, right? And there's a lot of psychological data around this to back it up. especially in an environment where there's a lot of uncertainty. So we're in a tight economic climate where the uncertainty is heightened, and therefore we're more likely to make decisions based on loss aversion. And that's where cost of inaction comes in, where you need to put a cost to what is, if I don't do this, so if I don't bridge these skills gaps, what is the cost to the business, right? If we don't have, say, for example, AI, let's just take AI. If we don't have AI skills based on the strategy that we have, what is the cost of doing this? And that cost could be missed opportunity, right? It could be losing market share to a competitor. It could be losing sales, right? Now, you might think, where am I going to get this data from? Well, speak to the people who are going to be most affected within the business, right? If you spoke to your head of sales, for example, or your head of marketing and asked them, are we losing opportunities to other competitors because we don't have ABC and we would need skills XYZ, and they would be able to quantify saying, yeah, actually, we lost X percentage of opportunities. This is the cost. Now, it's getting that data to build the cost of inaction is a more compelling reason to get buy-in from across the business. And the last one I'd say is also in my book, Learning at Speed, I talk about minimum valuable learning, which is essentially coming up with something where it's low effort, but is enough for you to start to get data to say that this learning is helping you move in the right direction of building the skills that you need, right? It could be a POC, a pilot, but just enough to move the dial to show something to the business to say, look, my hypothesis, I'm starting to validate it, and some of the assumptions have been validated. Now I need to get the buy-in to be able to scale this. And it's a great way of kind of de-risking what you're proposing to the business.
Yeah, I love all of that framing. There's an interesting copywriting exercise that I think maps well onto that. It's called the so what test, where every three sentences you're meant to ask yourself, so what? And if you can't, then you don't have good copy. And it's the same thing there. If we're saying, well, more people will do the course, everyone's going to say, so what? Well, if they do the course, then X, well, so what? But if we go skills first, the so what we can answer with, well, we need these skills to reach this goal, or the, you know, the cost of inaction could equal this much. So yeah, I really like that framing, and I'm sure it'd be useful to everyone listening as well. Perfect. We are doing great for time. So we do have about 15 minutes for the Q&A, like we said. But firstly, you heard a bit about HowNow and Easy Generator today. If you want to know a little bit more about what either of our companies do, you'll see a poll pop up very shortly. If you just tick yes to that, then someone from our respective teams will be in touch to give you some more information. So that should pop up in a second, and we will get started with the questions. There's a great one in the chat, actually, from Helen, that if you're in a company where time spent is looked at as it taking people away from their work. So if it appears like people are being taken out of their work to learn and it feels like it's competing, what would the advice be to move away from that and that perception in your company that it's a conflicting thing with your everyday work?
I'm happy to take this, Casper. I'm a big believer on you achieve what you measure. Right. And a good example of this is, you know, prior to getting smartwatches like your Fitbit to the world, etc., how many people used to count how many steps they made? Whereas now almost 10,000 steps is a part of mainstream pop culture. Right. And that's because we're now measuring it. We're now trying to achieve the 10,000 steps. So you achieve what you measure. And if your organization right now is only measuring time spent learning, what do you think you're going to achieve? You're going to achieve time spent learning, right? We used to, I remember this organization we used to work with where one of their targets was 40 hours a month. And I've never seen an organization where every employee was so focused on knowing how many hours they spent learning, and because their performance was targeted on it. So was it driving upskilling and learning? We don't know. But was it driving an interest in how many hours that content was open for? Absolutely, it did. Now, if what we wanted to drive was upskilling and we start to measure skills, what do you think you would achieve? You will achieve uplift in skills because that's what we're now measuring. So what you measure drives the behavior, right? It's much like how incentives drive the behavior. If you're measuring people for time spent learning, then you're going to get more time spent learning. But if you're measuring people for skills mastery, then you're probably going to get more skills mastery.
And this is a problem that happens on a big scale as well, because we spoke about it recently on the podcast, but Slack did this week-long shutdown where the target was 40 hours of learning. So it's still happening, even at these big companies with the huge learning teams and so on. But Casper, any thoughts from yourself on how we change the perception that learning is time away from someone's job and therefore less impactful?
Yeah, so I think that a couple of things there. So first, I think AI will be a big game changer there, because a lot of information will just be at your fingertips all the time. If you just look at ChatGPT, how easy it is to ask a question and get an answer, although that is not really reliable. But when you apply that technology to specific curated information, it becomes really valuable. So I think that will change a lot of things. But it goes beyond that, because I think that if you look at the change of learning, so if you say, for example, the example of setting the goal of 40 hours of learning for everybody, it should be connected to business goals. So people like Cathy Moore taught us that. It's about actionable learning, which is connected to business goals. So how it should work is that there's a business goal that drips down to the organization. So your manager has a goal. So he sits down with you and say, okay, we need to achieve this. And in order to do that, we need to be able to do this and this and that. And then you get a skill gap. So you need to fill that skill gap in order to actually achieve that goal. And that's what you have to measure. And I think we now have more and more technology. For example, we used to really track and trace learning with SCORM, which is just like, is it completed? How much time did you spend? Stuff like that. And we now have XAPI. We already have it for a decade, and it can track and trace much more. Nelson already mentioned learning doesn't happen just in your LMS or your LXP. It happens that when you're reading a blog, hopefully when you are listening to this conversation, you pick up something and stuff like that. And with XAPI, you're able to track and trace really different things. And one of the things that I'm really disappointed in, when XAPI was announced some more than 10 years ago, I thought it would actually become like an individual thing. So I track and trace my learning results. I set my goals. I track and trace my results. And it's my ownership. And then I determine, oh, wait a minute, this is interesting for the organization I work for. Then I share it with them. So it's a completely different perspective. And I think we're not there by far. But I think the flow of the business goal that sort of drives the skills development, and then that motivates people. And then you measure that, the impact of learning. That is, I think, really, really important.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's an interesting, we kind of alluded to it earlier, but a byproduct of being skills first is you build skills for context and where they're applied in the flow of work. So you don't need to take people outside of the flow of work to learn, and therefore it's not competing. I'll put the link in the chat to the trends report we published recently, because there's some stuff in there about vanity metrics and the skills first approach that does speak to what Casper and Nelson both shared there. We got a question a little while ago that I thought it would be good to come back to at the end, but essentially, the question is framed around, we're doing a 70-20-10 kind of model. So learning is happening outside of the formal channels. So is there any advice on how we measure the skills being built outside of the formal learning?
So the question is, how much skills are being built by formal learning, maybe?
Outside of the formal learning. So maybe, like you said, people are listening to podcasts, they're doing things on their own terms outside of the typical channels that the organization might have. It has like an LMS, for example. Any ways you can measure the skills that are being built in the more informal channels for learning, I think is the gist of it.
Yeah, so the question that comes to mind is, why do you want to measure that? So you just want people to have those skills, so when they get it, it's great. So maybe you want to have some insight in where they get it, so you can sort of stimulate that more. But also measuring learning and the impact of learning is also really an L&D thing, because you invest money and you want to sort of explain to the business why it was worthwhile to spend that money. And I think that's also a sort of old school mindset. In the new business that we're going through, the culture that you need, it needs to be your learning culture. It needs to be your knowledge sharing culture. So learning by default is part of the whole business approach. It's not separated from that, like we discussed just before. And if you look at that, then learning is not an investment. Learning is like a necessity. You need probably a building or Zoom to be able to connect to people and talk to each other. So and learning is no different than that. It's the glue that actually builds your company, holds things together.
Yeah. Nelson, it also feels a bit like an ecosystem issue. You mentioned ecosystem earlier, but if we're bringing together the things people are learning from in those informal channels into a central place, then we do have more visibility on how they're being used for someone's development, I guess.
Yeah, I think it goes back to what Casper was saying. The skills assessment and measurement isn't connected to a particular mode of content or training, right? It's not that, you know, their skills assessment based on formal learning is X and their skills assessment based on informal learning is Y. The content is besides the point. Like you said, in a diverse ecosystem, it could be anything. It could be because I got mentored by my manager. It could be any different type of learning opportunity or learning resource. What separates a skills assessment is a skills assessment, right? It is understanding what level of mastery does this person have in their skill is unconnected to wherever that skill came from, formal, informal, what channel it came from. Now, I get, like Casper said, you're trying to probably, for L&D's sake, trying to demonstrate the impact of L&D and prove the ROI of investment. And you know, we work with many L&D professionals, and I hear this often as a challenge. Now, this is where we go. You look at both the quantitative and the qualitative data, right? The quantitative data is the skills measurement. You might look at data that shows you evidently that the average skills proficiency for negotiation skills has gone from a 3 to a 4 across your revenue teams, for example. You might also look at business performance data, and you can see actually your sales conversion rate has gone from a 10% baseline, and in 6 months, it's gone up to 20%. They're quantitative skills and performance data that shows that it's moved in the right direction. Now, your next question to me might be, yeah, but just because the number moved, it doesn't mean L&D actually had an impact. This is where you can close off the story with qualitative data. You interview the people who are involved, right? You speak to people on the sales team. You speak to the head of sales. You speak to the rest of the business. You speak to customers. You speak to partners. And then you start to understand, okay, why did you change your behavior? What kind of influenced you to change your behavior? And in that qualitative data, you'll start to hear stories around, well, I looked at this nugget, or I read this blog, or I went on this mentoring session, which helped me change the way I did that. Now, combining that qualitative data with your quantitative data helps you build that impact narrative to say, actually, the work we did in L&D did influence this person's behavior change, which resulted in us acquiring and developing the required skills within the organization. You know, no one in the business is asking you to prove that L&D was the only thing that drove this behavior, right? There is not a single function in the business that operates in this way. And this is why I have a really, this African concept that which I absolutely love called Ubuntu. And it's this idea that I can't do what I do without you doing what you do. And it's no, you know, an organization is Ubuntu in practice, where no function could do something without the other function doing something. And the same is true for L&D. So we're not looking for L&D as the sole drivers. We're looking for an impact narrative that shows that L&D has influenced that business performance improvement.
And it's really interesting that you say that, because that really connects to a trend that I see happening more and more, is that in the old days, we were looking at L&D result data tech. And what's now happening more and more, that more companies have data lakes where they have all kind of performance and business data. And with XAPR, you're able to actually add the learning data to it. And then on a high level, you can start seeing patterns. So you see patterns where certain training coincides with improvement of output in the business. And then you can dive in deeper. And you don't see it on an individual level, but you can see trends. And sometimes, so I heard from one of our customers, so one of the first things they found that they were actually overtraining their people. There was like a negative correlation between training and performance that you could see in the data. Wow. So they actually brought it back and performance went up. So it's really interesting. And that's not on an individual level, but so you don't need to look at data from learning by itself, but you need to integrate it with the learning with the data from the company. And that becomes now possible. So all the things, like a lot of the technological boundaries that we had, they're sort of removing with the technology we have. So it's much more that we are now the limitation on how to use that technology for the best. But I think almost everything is now possible. Like things like this, you couldn't imagine it like 10 years ago. And now it's like just you almost get it out of the box.
Yeah, No, I totally agree. A couple minutes left, so I've got a bit of a quick fire one for you, but any advice on how we can compel our teams or the rest of the business to take action on skills? I suppose we covered some of the real data points at the start. We talked about the cost of inaction as well, but anything else come to mind on getting others to take action and be invested in skills as well?
I would probably challenge themselves on their own job and looking at that and just imagining, so what do I need to be able to do in 1 or 2 years' time to be still relevant for my function? And that probably makes them realize how much they need to do upskilling themselves and then project that onto the rest of the business and be aware of how important it is.
Yeah, and I'd say we often make the misconception in L&D that, I've heard it so many times where we go, I'm not too sure our company are ready for a skills first, or I'm not too sure our people are ready for continuous learning. And what you're saying is you don't know if you're ready to be able to drive that change in the organization, because the reality is every single person in that organization in some shape or form is probably learning outside of work, right? And they are probably listening to a podcast, they're probably tuning into a webinar, they are reading books and they're doing this. It's just not within your visibility. And so we make the mistake of assuming, oh, they're not motivated to learn, they don't want to learn. No, they're doing it outside, right? If you're not helping them get those skills, they'll get those skills some other way and join another company that's going to better support their growth. And what we're trying to do here is not to get them learning. They're probably learning in some shape or form, but it's to reduce the friction involved in learning is what our job is, right? We're saying, look, you're probably already doing this and hacking together a solution, but my job here is to A, take out the friction involved with you upskilling, but also my job here is to give you the confidence and conviction that you're learning the right stuff, right? And this is where L&D can really help you identify the unknown unknowns, right? As an individual, I'm really good at driving self-directed learning for the known unknowns, right? I know I'm not good at this. I know I don't know this. That's where self-directed learning is great. I'll go find it. And whereas L&D are great at looking at bigger data sets, where is the company going? What's happening in my industry? And asking the strategic questions to go, these are the unknown unknowns. You don't know yet as an individual, you need this. But let me tell you, you're going to need this for this reason. And that's where L&D can help. So I would suggest L&D, don't waste your time on the known unknowns. Just create the ecosystem and an environment for it to happen in a frictionless way. Prioritize your time in building a strategy around the unknown unknowns, because that's where you can add the biggest value.
Brilliant. I love that. And that takes us perfectly to time. So I just want to say thank you to everyone who joined us today and leaving so many great questions and comments in the chat and the Q&A. And a massive thank you to Casper and Nelson for joining us for this conversation.